you're wrong about that. You did it badly. You're a terrible CTO. You know, I don't say that. Imagine how bad that would sound, right?
Yeah, not good for customer relationships.
I wouldn't get anybody to work with me.
Hey, welcome, Adelina. So you've worked with hundreds of engineers and CTOs in the last decade. What's the biggest pitfall that you've seen them in transitioning from being an engineer to a CTO?
The biggest pitfall is the fact that they go into the CTO role and start applying the individual contributor mindset that they have and is an engineer to their CTO role, which is actually a strategic and sometimes operational role.
So does that apply to CTOs of all level, or are we particularly talking of startups here?
Well, it's a very good question, actually, because I used to think that it only applies to CTOs in startups. However, okay. I have found some CTOs in some major scale-ups who somehow, through luck, ended up a CTO at this company of 500 people, but they still had that individual contributor mindset that they had 5 years ago, 8 years ago, when they started as CTO in a small startup.
So what are the kind of mistakes that you see them making in those scenarios?
Oh, the core mistakes I see them making are that they hoard code. They just think that they are the alpha geek in the room and they should be the one that has all the technical answers for everybody. They also kind of intimidate people and scare them a bit. You know, they make them feel scared to speak up because they get offended when people speak up because they think that I'm the chief technology officer, the biggest authority in this room. So nobody should contradict me. Nobody. They completely, completely miss the point of what the role of CTO is about. You know, about nurturing other engineers to come up with ideas. And another key mistake they make, and this is on a completely different level, is they speak geek speak in the boardroom. You know, they talk in the boardroom about bug reports and technical debt without explaining the so what. Why should the business care about these things?
So unpacking that, we've got a kind of toxic environment, creating a single point of failure, and talking a foreign language to the board.
Yes. So and those are just three, okay? There's a million others we can list.
So if we start unpacking that, what can they do to create a less toxic environment and creating a good environment that people are going to want to work for them and with them rather than run away and find another role?
Yeah, so first of all, when someone contradicts them, you know, when they have the guts to contradict them to begin with, they shouldn't try and put them down by saying, I disagree, you are wrong. Even if, let's say, the engineer says 2 + 2 = 5, and, you know, as you know, that's not true, not putting them down like that, like black and white, hardcore, you're wrong type of language, because it when it comes from the CTO, that has a bigger impact than if it just comes from another engineer. You know, it just has a different kind of status, different kind of clout. Therefore, it's really important for them to ask them questions to help them realize their own mistake, rather than saying things like, I disagree, that would never work, you don't know what you're talking about, that's wrong. That kind of language, that kind of very harsh language, really makes the engineers scared. And the other actually language I've seen was when the CTO says, I feel hurt and upset by your words. That, again, as a CTO, you should never say something like that to your engineers. You know, you're meant to be, even if their words hurt you, it would be good initially to understand more about what is it about their words that hurts you, and for you to analyze that with a coach rather than in front of them and telling them that kind of thing really, really makes the engineers very twitchy and anxious afterwards.
So it's interesting you say that, because I've posted recently on LinkedIn about how we talk to people, and a lot of engineers push back and say, but I want people to be blunt. I want to be able to talk to people bluntly. So is that all talk? Or do you disagree with them?
Oh, I love that question. So You know, on your my CV, you can see that I did some training at ARM, and one of the training sessions that we carried out there was called "Unappreciated from Being Honest: How to Tell Them That They're Wrong." So that was a course exactly for that type of engineer who wants to be very direct. And I used to be one of those people. I used to like to be, and I still am, very direct. But directness matters in context. You know, if you have a higher status than the people that you're disagreeing with, you have to be very gentle in your disagreement because you can really crush them. And then they'll never tell you stuff anyway. So it completely messes up your leadership because you'll find out about problems very late. If, however, you're an engineer with another engineer, also being harsh, actually, especially trying to prove to someone else that they're wrong, there's a difference, you know, between being direct and being harsh. You know, I'm very direct, but I'm not necessarily harsh. You know, when I give feedback to CTOs and tell them that they're not quite doing things the right way. You know, I don't tell them you're wrong about that. You did it badly. You're a terrible CTO. You know, I don't say that. Imagine how bad that would sound, right?
Yeah, not good for customer relationships.
I wouldn't get anybody to work with me.
Cool. So can you give us another example of how engineers might talk to each other one-to-one that would be, you know, direct, blunt, but not harsh, and that is harsh? So a bit of a contrast from some of the studies you've seen.
Yeah. So, you know, for example, if an engineer starts with, I disagree, I think you're wrong, right? If an engineer starts with that, then obviously that puts the other person on the defensive straight away. If, however, the engineer starts with, I'm not sure about that. This is the piece where I don't quite understand. It doesn't quite match because in my mind, 2 + 2 = 4, not 5, but happy to discuss it, right? You see, it's the same thing. You told them they're wrong, but you didn't kind of attack them emotionally. Does that make sense?
That does. But again, I'll come back to a number of engineers have commented on my recent LinkedIn post.
I didn't see it. I must look at it. Yeah.
I argued for some of these kind of things, and a lot of people came back and said, I hate that. It's unauthentic. It's fluffy BS.
Yeah.
You're not being genuine. I don't want to work with people like that. It's very toxic.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean.
I can kind of see their point of view, but the flip side is it's equally toxic being that harsh.
And exactly.
If they're on the receiving end of that harshness, I'm sure those same people would be just as offended as the rest of us. We're all humans.
Yes. So
what advice do you have for them?
Beautiful, beautiful question, John. Thank you so much. Absolutely beautiful question. I'm so glad you're hammering down on this because it's a really important point. And it's this kind of finesse of things that people miss. Very important point you make. So this is why I ran that course, Unappreciated for Being Honest, How to Tell Them They're Wrong. Mm-hmm. Because the people who say, because I used to think the same. I used to think, well, I'm direct. It's your problem if you get offended, right? I used to feel
too.
Exactly the
Me
same.
Too.
Guilty as charged, right? Yep. So, but here's the thing, right? When I understood that the human brain, you know, has effectively at the most basic level, these two levels, you know, the emotional brain and the logical brain. And the emotional brain gets triggered when someone disagrees with you in harsh terms, like, I disagree, I think you're wrong, what the hell are you talking about? You know, humiliation in front of others, you know, because you don't know any better. What the hell are you talking about? This is ridiculous. All of these things kind of being super harsh and direct in this kind of way. It's a demeaning way. That's the problem. Or it's an embarrassing way. It's the emotion attached to the directness. That's why I'm saying you can be direct, but not cruel. Yeah. And that's the difference. And I think a lot of engineers don't understand that refinement, that I am all for directness. I like to be very authentic, and I tell people things even when I know they won't like what I'm telling them. And I'm very well known for that. However, I also take into account the fact that making sure I'm not humiliating them in the process, you know, making sure I'm not talking down at them and trying to big myself up. Well, I knew this all along. Things like that. Right. Yeah. These kind of expressions. I knew this all along, or I already knew that you're basically behind, stuff like that. Or everyone else knows this. Why are you the only one who doesn't? Horrible, horrible thing. Right. And it's that emotional brain that gets attacked when we have this harsh language. Harsh language does not mean being honest and direct. They're very, very different things. And I think people miss the distinction between the two.
Yeah. And again, I think the example there for my post the other day was swapping the word but for and.
Yeah.
And it's a tiny thing. And
yes.
The reason I wrote about that is because I upset a CEO regularly by using the word but.
Yeah.
Everything he came upon, I said yes.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. I can see the argument in there already, right? But, yeah.
Well, many of his ideas were crazy, so it was quite a struggle not to say but.
Yeah.
However, once or twice might have been fine. It was every time we had the conversation, that word but in it. And to a certain extent, I felt, at the time, I felt, you're a grown man. Yeah. You've had 40 years of work experience.
Yeah.
You should have reached a level of emotional maturity that you're not offended by me saying but.
Yeah.
When we're clearly on the same side, we're trying to achieve the same goal.
Mm-hmm.
So it took me a little while to realize just quite how hurt he was by this.
Yeah.
So now I've recognized that, and I try to change. I try to do better. I'm not perfect. We talked about the CTO not talking to the board at the right level. How do we bring that back up to the board level? And do you see the same thing there, that the CTO is talking to the board very bluntly and very directly? And again, coming across with this harshness and talking technical and being almost as the way we talk to other engineers and we talk to the computer, and that these are facts, we're discussing them. And,
yeah.
And not getting to the point. Tell us what you've seen there.
Yeah, so at board level, it's slightly different, because at board level, most engineers, I would say, try not to be rude, try not to be as direct, although they don't necessarily, most of them don't necessarily say you're wrong or things like that at board level. But the presentations they make to the board to give a status update on engineering, or to demonstrate their vision for engineering with regards to how this is going to help the company achieve its goals, that is still harsh. So that is still very technical and no connection to the business, no connection to how this is going to help us reach this market, how is it going to help us with customer retention, how is it going to help us with customer satisfaction, There is no connection between the engineering work and the business. It's just like, we're doing our thing, engineers being engineers. It's up to you to figure out how that helps the business. And obviously the board would be like, no, we're not. And that's why often CTOs like that, they think that the board wants to know details of how engineering works, because they start asking questions like, so how does embedded software help us? And that's not what the board mean by that. They mean, how is embedded software going to help us make money? Which is the actual question. But just to finish off on that, they do have an arrogance with the board. So often they look down at the board as these peasants who don't understand technology. And the board members can tell. Because, a lot of board members have better soft skills and better, kind of psychological understanding of people than a lot of CTOs have. And obviously that doesn't go down well at all. And they often are removed from the board when they have that kind of attitude, to be honest.
Okay, so there's two things I wanted to follow up on there. One is to talk about the course you showed me the other day that you have recently released about how to convince the board to buy into something.
Yeah.
But I was just going to pull a little bit of string there, talking about the soft skills. There was a video I saw on YouTube a couple of days ago reflecting on a recruiter sent a very nasty email to an engineer who missed an interview due to confusion about time zones. The guy commenting on this in his video made the observation that engineers as a population probably have a lower average level of soft skills than the population in general has on average. Again, talking average across the whole population of software engineers and the whole population of the world.
Yeah.
Does that match your experience?
Honestly, on average, potentially. I have also seen engineers with amazing empathy. But I'd say on average, I suppose they do need soft skills more than a lot of, and by soft skills, I mean actually understanding how people tick, You know, communication skills to understand how does your communication land. You know, everyone needs influencing, presentation, negotiation skills, and those are very much needed by engineers too. But the one skill that a lot of neurotypicals get, that a lot of neurodiverse people like me, who I'm also neurodiverse, you know, like a lot of engineers that I work with, a lot of neurodiverse people like me don't get, is that natural understanding of how your language comes across. You know, like we said earlier about the refinement between being direct and being indirect is seen as being a liar almost. So, you know, being direct and being harsh. There's a difference in those terms. But when you are neurodiverse, sometimes I'm not sure you really get that. And I didn't get that early on. You know, I had to people to explain to me, very kind people, who explained to me that when I speak like that, I'm harsh to people, and I'm harming people's feelings. I'm making people feel negatively towards me, even though I was honest. And, you know, oh, honesty hurts, or whatever expression, you know, people, truth hurts, whatever expression people like to use. But truth is a logical, truth is also a subjective thing sometimes, but also even if logically, yes, you were wrong about 2 + 2 = 5, my ego is hurt. You proved me wrong in front of other people, or you made fun of that.
Yeah, that's the way you deliver it. Again, if you think back to that kind of school environment, your teachers don't tend, or a good teacher won't humiliate you in front of the class. They will have a quiet word and pick that out.
Yes.
Cool. So I mentioned your course there. You have a course that you've recently put up that's how to influence people, and you talked about that kind of embedded software example within it. Would you like to tell people about the course and what that is?
Yes, how it can help them? Yeah, so at the moment it's only been launched through a handful of newsletters for engineers and CTOs, including yours, I believe.
Soon.
It's called How to Get the Board to Say Yes to Engineering Spend. And it's based on a real situation that I worked on with a chief technology officer who had about 15 years experience in about 4,000 people company. You know, this is not a 25-year-old who just started a business yesterday, right? And we were talking about, so in the video, I give a specific example of what the CTO told the board and the CEO in the first instance, and how that didn't work for 9 months at every board meeting. And then how I helped him change his message and language to present the exact same business case, but in business terms, rather than in engineering software design terms, which is what was presented to begin with.
I looked through the video and I really liked the contrast. It was excellent at showing. I could almost have sat in that presentation, the original one, several times. I have, not about embedded software, but I've almost word for word seen the same thing.
Yeah.
And I've pushed people to make the second presentation, which did. So I thought it was a great contrast and example.
Thank you.
My obvious question from it, though, is where's the follow-up? Where's the live course where you're going to take people through an example and building on that and, you know, work with them some case studies?
I don't have a live course booked yet because I'm recording a few other courses at the moment. But if people are interested in attending a live course, I'm more than happy for them to message me, and I can happily organize one if there is interest in something like that. Right now, I don't have anything booked in because I'm so busy recording so many other courses. You know, one of them is going to come out on Udemy by the end of April. And it will be about how do you transition from engineer to CTO in under 3 years.
Cool. Let's dig into that in a minute. But I think watching your course, I really liked what was shown. I think a lot of people will look at that, and it's probably easy for you to make the translation and see, but a lot of people that are making that first presentation will struggle with how do I make that step? What are the steps to go through to make that transition? And I think you and I would find it quite easy. We've done it many times, and maybe we just think it's quite obvious and easy because we've done it before.
Yes.
Can you kind of distill 3 or 4 steps that they might take to go from this is my embedded software, or this is my technical debt, to why this matters to the business and how it's going to help?
Oh, brilliant question, John, as always. Yeah, fantastic. Yes. So the first step a CTO needs to make in order to get the right information. So this is what I discovered, that most of them didn't have the right information at their fingertips, that because they never think about it in that in those terms. So the first step is to speak to the other departments to understand what is the impact of engineering on customer satisfaction, on market share, on customer acquisition. How can we, and actually, frankly, that, so weirdly, sometimes some CTOs, in the case of this particular CTO, do have those conversations, but they don't include that. And that's how they kind of get to the conclusion that they need to change, you know, things, but they don't share that to the board. So they know that they're losing market share. You know, why would a company bother to redesign a successful product? Why would you? When
Yeah,
it's been working for
absolutely.
20 years. But when you're losing market share because your competition has this updated way of the product functioning and is less intrusive or less inconvenient for customers, then you are going to start losing market share. And frankly, if you go to the point where you're losing market share, it's too late.
Yeah.
So, customer satisfaction surveys, customer dropouts, customer renewal of membership, whatever it is that your business model is, speaking to customer success, to sales, to customer acquisition teams, depends on what you have within your business, but speaking to the CFO as well to understand how much do things cost. Sometimes CTOs have no idea of the cost of engineering. And having,
Yeah, I've seen that before.
yeah, so speaking to the CFO, speaking to the CEO, and also having these conversations with the rest of the C-suite as part of making a plan and making the decision of what should change, rather than, oh, I decide in my lab that actually we need to redesign this because it's the coolest new tech out there. So what is the coolest new tech out there? Does it bring us any money? Does it save us any money? Otherwise, we don't care. So those are the steps, you know, speak to the customer success. Step two, speak to the CFO. Step three, speak to the CEO. And after you've spoken to all these people, go back to them actually with a draft idea and plan, and get and discuss with them the options. Like, for example, in my presentation, you see there that the CTO says, well, I've spoken to customer success and they have alternative plans of how to keep in touch with the customers. Because obviously, removing the need for the customer to come back every 2, 3 years or whatever, it removes that kind of customer touch point.
Yeah.
But I've spoken to them, so it shows the collaboration with the rest of the C-suite, and they have alternative plans for this. So showing, see that kind of, so checking in with them, how would this look like for you? How will this impact you if we change this? Not just, we're going to change this, it's going to be great, it's the best tech in the world. Goodbye.
So I very much try and sum that up as it's talk to their team, which is the C-suite.
Yes.
Not to their team, as they think of it, of the
Yes.
engineers.
Yes.
Talk to your first team, and as a CTO, your first team is that
The
executive management
C-suite,
team.
yeah.
Something you said there, I think, is very interesting, and I've seen it time and again at every level. Engineers, all the way from junior to senior to CTO, do not know what it costs for an engineer.
Yeah.
What would you suggest they think of and realize? What points are they missing?
Sorry, do you mean the cost of having an engineer working for the business,
Yes.
or yeah? So absolutely important point. A lot of CTOs don't speak to the CFO, and this is actually another interesting angle that I've seen. A lot of CFOs are equally introverted and poor communicators, as many CTOs are. Therefore, you have two not great communicators and quite siloed thinking folks not talking to each other. But if you start building bridges with the rest of your first team, as you called it, especially with a CFO as well, who can tell you how much it costs the business for every engineer you have on your team, you can then be every decision you make, it will help you understand better how much it will cost, will be the cost of engineering to the business to produce that feature. Of course, engineer salaries are not the only thing, but they are a good chunk of the expenditure, for sure.
But even then, I have met engineers throughout my career who think, we are paying somebody 50,000, that's what they cost. And that's barely the half of it in many cases. The fully loaded cost of that engineer will be somewhere between 1.5 and 2 times what their basic salary is, depending on bonuses, depending on your tax regime, depending on infrastructure and office costs. So I know plenty of places where whatever the salary is, the fully loaded cost will be approximately double. And a lot of
Absolutely.
engineers, a lot of CTOs miss that.
A
And when I
hundred
say,
percent.
I want 50,000 to hire another engineer, like, well, that means you can pay them 25 grand and you're not going to get much for that.
It's an excellent point you make. So they often underestimate how much it will cost to actually acquire and make an engineer high performing. So hiring an engineer is very different than the cost of the business of that engineer, because the engineer takes at least 6 months to start performing in that business. So the first 6 months is just an investment, first of all. But the other thing is that also the resource. So yes, all of the costs you mentioned, you know, the tax implications, resource, etc. But actually, it's also the cost of the opportunity that the company is missing, because the most experienced engineer has to spend a lot of time in onboarding this engineer into the code, showing them how things work. They often forget to calculate that time as well, because actually, imagine if you have five experienced engineers who understand how things work and you're adding 10 new people. Those five new engineers are actually going to spend 90% of their time helping those 10 new people learning how stuff works. They're going to be less productive than they were before.
They are, and they don't have to be. I've written quite passionately on LinkedIn recently about this and onboarding, that most companies make an absolute mess of their onboarding.
Oh, God,
And
yeah.
it shouldn't take 6 months to get somebody up to speed in most companies and to get them to being productive. We should be able to do that far quicker, but most hiring managers don't put the effort into. They think of hiring as, I write a quick job spec, and normally they don't do a very good job of that. I do some interviews. They don't really do a good job of that. They pick some questions off the internet or whatever. And then somebody turns up. I greet them, give them some tickets, and off they go. It needs to be more of a process than that. Hiring should be, what do we really need? When do we need them? And planning 6 months in advance, if possible. Writing a job spec that details what are the skills and capabilities and attitudes and aptitudes we really need. And then designing an interview process that goes through not some question you found off the internet, but how do I test? How do I create a rubric against which to grade answers that I get? And how do I test for the skills I have? And then how do I conduct an interview? How do I question people in such a way that I get the best out of them? I give them a chance to shine, because confrontational interviews where you try and trick people aren't going to tell you anything other than who's good at that kind of interviewing. You want questions that draw the best out of somebody, that are fairly broad but allow you to go deep on where their strengths are and where their experience is, and extract that best. And then when it comes to onboarding, that doesn't start on their first day. It starts from the
Before.
moment you finish that interview and decide you're going to hire them. In dealing well with them, giving them a good experience, getting, if they're remote, a laptop or something out to them beforehand, getting all their usernames and passwords, getting all the pre-startup stuff that they need if there's any regulations that affect you. And most of the time, people don't invest in that. They don't set that up. So I'm passionately kind of frustrated by our industry and how badly we do all of that.
Oh, I agree. And I mean, one of the key things I say to startups as well, because in a corporate, okay, that's a drop in the ocean. They don't even care, and it doesn't even show how badly that impacts that team, at least, you know, in a corporate. But in a startup, if you do it like that, you are missing out on huge opportunity there, because you could get the engineer to start documenting stuff for you, because startups are well known for poor documentation, because they're rushing to get the product to market. And asking the onboarding engineer to start doing documentations for you is a brilliant way for them to learn the stuff, so be while being productive, and also being productive and speeding up the onboarding for other people who come after them.
Yeah, for the next person behind them. I mean, I spent a lot of my time as a contractor, about a third of my career. And one of the things I've often done is come on, and again, as a contractor, you are expected to hit the ground running and start adding value from day one. Almost inevitably, the first way I've started doing that is joining a company and starting to go through saying, what's your onboarding? Like, I'm going to tidy this up for the person after me and make them productive and start feeding back. Perhaps that's another reason why I view productivity in 6 months is not possible, because in the UK, a lot of the contracting market was a 3 month contract. If you hadn't created value in the first 3 months, you would not get a renewal. So you had to deliver value.
Yeah.
And some of the contracts, some of the projects you'd be brought on for as a contract, you know, the project was due to deliver in 5 months' time. You know, you got a 3 month contract and you were helping to get that delivery. If you got extended it with another 2 months till you delivered and the project was done, then that's why you have contract resource. It would be goodbye on to the next one. I'd like to take us back now. You mentioned the course for becoming an engineer to a CTO in 3 years. That's an interesting course for you to put out, because we just talked about how a lot of CTOs don't have the right skill set. A lot of engineers move too quickly.
Yeah.
It almost seems like the opposite of that. You're maybe helping them move too quickly. So
you
could let's dig into
there.
That.
Yeah. So why did I label this course like this? It's something that a lot of engineers search for, and it's something that a lot of engineers dream about. But I've decided to put this course, the first lesson on the course explains the key difference in skills that they're going to need to upgrade to actually live and breathe being a CTO. And are they really committed to make that upgrade first? So that's the first
lesson. So the first lesson is don't do this course.
Yeah, the first lesson is don't do this course. And then afterwards, I give them 5 practical ways. So I go, if you're committed, awesome, let's go for it. Because, you know, some people are, and they're brilliant CTOs. You know, I've met some phenomenally good first-time CTOs. But the difference between them and those who are not good CTOs is that they want to learn. That's the key difference. So I give them then 5. I go, if you're sure, let's go ahead, right? And then I give them 5 practical ways they can become CTO in under 3 years that I have seen my real CTO customers become CTO from engineer in under 3 years. But I do say to them, there'll be other courses following. Once you're in that job, there'll be lots of things you need to learn and worry about. But, you know, a lot of people just want the outcome, right? And this is why I always say to them, that's great, you want the outcome. Here is how to get there. This is how a lot of people got there. But it doesn't mean you're going to get what you think you want.
Yeah, I think a lot of engineers forget that when you step from being an individual contributor to being a manager, whether that's an engineer, manager, director, VP, or CTO, you are going back to step one. You're going back to being a beginner.
Yes.
It is a different career path.
Yes.
And, you know, you've gone down a snake. You've gone past go and you have to go to jail. You know, you are going back to the beginning and step one, and you have to start again.
Absolutely.
So you highlight 5 things there. Don't want to spoil the course, but maybe what's one of them that you could pick out as a bit of a sample taster?
Yeah, sure. Well, so one of them, actually, I'll give you 2 of them even if you want. I mean, one of them, I describe how you can become, because, you know, a lot of people realize that they can become a CTO very quickly if they're a founder. But how do you become a founder? So I start breaking down for them in very concrete things how to become a CTO founder, how to get those opportunities, where to get those opportunities, what organizations to speak to. Like, it's extremely, extremely specific. And even if you live somewhere else in the world, I tell you exactly what to look for in your area. So that's one of them. And then the other one gives you, helps you understand what you need to be doing in your current role to be promoted to CTO in that company, if it's a particular type of company, and I tell them what kind of company that has to be, or how to do things in that company that next you can be easily given the job title of CTO in the next role you apply for. So it's all very, very specific advice, very clear, not the big airy-fairy stuff that I've seen on, you know, a lot of the internet. There's lots of articles about how to become a CTO, but they're all very general, like learn how to be a strategist. Okay, thanks.
So being a founder is easy. Yeah, I did it.
Yeah.
You just start a company, call yourself founder.
Yeah. Boom. No, but I mean a founder in an invested company. You know, I meant an actual founder in a company that has backing.
Oh, I'm going to pull that one.
I'll go on. Go ahead. I love it. You'll love your questions. They're very good.
Well, I've run my current business for 16, 17 years, 18 years maybe, alongside a few other things. And my business before that, I ran for 6 years.
Yeah.
Neither of them were backed. Both companies have been bootstrapped.
Yeah.
One of them has done millions in sales.
Yeah.
Each year. So what does being backed have to do with it?
Well, what I mean by that, and obviously, absolutely, for example, if you call yourself CTO in your company, if you're selling millions, then you are actually a true CTO. What I'm talking about is what I didn't mean people to think is that I'm going to say to you, just go on LinkedIn, start your own thing and call yourself CTO. And that's it. You're CTO another 3 years. That's what I didn't want people to think that I'm encouraging them to do. What I meant by a backed company, I meant that you are a CTO of a company with co-founders, that you are selling something, even if it is that you're selling an idea that some investors bought. You know, there is some sort of interaction with the market that validates the fact that you are a company, you are something offering something of value. That's what I meant by backed. Backed by customers, backed by investors.
Okay, so we could pull on things like ConvertKit and Buffer, which are, I believe, both bootstrapped, have been very successful. Mm-hmm. But a couple of founders started them and bootstrapped them. Okay, cool.
So, you know, backed doesn't mean just backed by investors. It also means backed by customers.
Yeah, we all proven by sales. Actual market success. Yes. Not you hid in your bedroom for a year and built some tech that nobody bought.
So, you know, I've seen lots of people. In fact, I've had a couple of people who've been horribly critical of me on LinkedIn. And when I looked, and they had their job title CTO on LinkedIn, and when I looked at their company, they were basically a self-employed software engineer who called himself CTO. And it was always himself, CTO. That is not a CTO. That is just someone who just consults as a software developer and decided to big themselves up.
But those people do get hired. You know, CEOs hire those people because they've been a CTO.
Not the right ones. I would say my experience, you know, if you're hired by someone because you... So here's the two red flags there. So if you're hired by a startup because you either attended an Oxbridge CTO course and that they think that makes you a CTO, or because you self-labeled as CTO when you're a one-man band doing software development, that is actually not a good employer to work for anyway. So again, back to market validation. I normally see those people dying within 3 to 5 years anyway, those companies.
Yeah. And I've seen a few of them. Maybe we've discussed one or two of those examples in the past where there's a company that's 5 years old and has had 3 to 5 CTOs already. I think that's quite a red flag. And that suggests that something's wrong and they keep repeating that pattern.
Yes, 100%.
So and they don't know what they want.
Yeah.
Sorry?
They don't know what they want.
All right. Okay. And maybe they got what they paid for as well. Maybe they weren't.
Yeah. You know what they say? You pay peanuts, you get monkeys.
Yeah. So back to our engineer who's looking to go from engineer to CTO in 3 years.
Yeah.
How do they avoid being like that then? How do they, whatever skills they need to gain so they can make that step?
Yeah. So that was less than one I mentioned. So basically the key things is that they have to... Coming back to your original point about the pitfall, the key thing is that they have to make a mind shift from individual contributor to strategic contributor. And that means learning how to lead people, learning how to speak to people, to inspire and influence them. That means learning how to create a vision, how to create goals for a team, learning how to influence the board, how to present to the board, learning how to negotiate and push back to the board. Because that's another big problem that CTOs have, and not just first-time CTOs, but many, many CTOs I've worked with. They struggle to negotiate with the board realistic timelines. And then they just kind of fall behind and they're seen as not credible. Because you're much more credible if you tell the board, I can do this by this date, instead of just saying, no, that can't be done. That's not going to work. So they seem to have three gears. No, it doesn't work. It can't be done. I will say yes to everything and hope for the best. And the best one is obviously saying, I can do this by this date. and kind of, you know, it's implying we can't really do that by that date, but I can do this by this date. So being a proactive person in co-creating with the board what can be realistically delivered rather than letting them down and constantly losing credibility, either because they said yes when they knew it's not going to happen, or because they said no in such a destructive way that they just are seen as obstructive rather than as constructive.
Yeah, no is not a valid answer in that, is it? You're there to figure out how we deliver the technology
exactly
to achieve the strategy. So
yeah,
no, it can't be done means you're not fit for the job.
Yes. Yes.
Or, and again, arguably the same point, you haven't explained to the board why what they're looking for is not achievable, which again boils down to you're not in the right position being able to explain it to them.
Yeah.
So how can a CTO that's in that position, maybe doesn't quite have the right skills, how can they go about acquiring them? Where can they come to you for help?
So with regards to acquiring those skills, obviously I can help them because that's why I talk about this a lot, because I'm really passionate, to be honest, about getting engineers be respected and credible members in the boardroom. We need them to be, actually, to get great technology out there quickly. So really, it's good for the world if they are. So they can, I can do one-to-one sessions with them and help them in that way. They also can try doing lots of soft skills, you know, if their employer has, you know, presentation, negotiation, influencing skill, just do them anyway, because they'll might give you a tiny little tool. It doesn't mean you'll necessarily know how to apply that straight away. But when I talk to you about them in session and I show you how it applies in reality to your real work situations, you'll have a bit of a familiarity to it rather than it being a completely novel concept. And this is what I found, that the CTOs that benefited the most from working with me were that either they saw a training video that I made online first, and then they came to me and had lots of questions about it, just like you asked about the steps to take between, you know, doing this presentation and that quality presentation. And it just helps them accelerate their improvement when they have someone like me on their side. And I actually never recommend coaching as the only solution to their problems. And that's something that, if you want, I'll happily explain and explore.
Okay, I'm going to dig into a couple of things there as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, when I was making a few mistakes in my own handling of an executive team, one of the things I looked to do is work with an executive coach and figure out ways that I could deal with things better. Mm-hmm. And another thing that I picked up on was one of the VPs at Google, I think it was, had written or been mentioning one of the books about the company that he'd written a user guide for how to use him. Very engineer thing to do. This is my user manual.
Yep.
And I mentioned both of these to some of the executive team that I was working on, and I got quite negative responses. They're like, oh, you're such a nerd. Or, yeah, quite negative about it, and said that it would undermine my credibility. What do you think to that? How do you think that a CTO or an engineer manager, somebody that's looking to do that, can approach that within the business or with outside? Do you think that reflects on the benefit of it, or do you think it reflects badly on, say, that executive team? Sorry, that was a lot of questions.
To have a user manual for yourself as a CTO that you share with your C-suite colleagues, is that what you mean?
That was something that I was looking at, yes. I was not CTO, but I was on that team.
Yeah. So I can see how that's a very much an engineering approach, a very geeky approach. I would actually quite like it, and I think that would be quite fun, but I'm not the target audience, right? Because the target audience are normally neurotypicals who look at something like that and go, ooh, your status would be lowered by this. So again, it's about coming back to who are we, are you trying to influence? If you're trying to influence other engineers, that kind of manual will probably go down very nicely. However, if you're trying to influence some neurotypical people who have a sales background, marketing background, very commercial finance background, they will look at that and think, oh, that's strange. That's not how we do things around here. Therefore, they are right. Probably might lower your credibility. So again, sharing those kind of things with them, you know, if for example, it depends on what was shared in that kind of manual, for example, you know, like to, I, you know, I process things like this, or I, you know, I like ideas to be sent to me a week in advance so I can read them before the board meeting. Or it depends on what was in that manual, because there are other softer ways to get that information across to them, to understand each other and work well as a team, other than just through a manual.
So that's it. And I was a bit of a leading question there, because okay. a few years later, I joined another company. I would say the average age of everyone in that engineering organization, including the product owners, was late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
And they had a culture throughout of creating those user guides all the way up to the CTO.
Yeah.
So I also think it's a bit of an age thing now. And again, I've seen on LinkedIn a few people talking about this. And maybe it's a small sample size, but it does seem to be more common amongst the ladies who are CTOs and VP engineers that they're promoting that within their teams.
Mm.
And again, it does seem to be at the younger end of the spectrum. And
mm.
I think I quite like the way that the culture is changing as we
absolutely
fresh your ideas and maybe more open to discussing this, maybe more accepting amongst the younger generation.
I was going to write actually a LinkedIn post about this. I've been working with some very young leaders recently, and I am really hopeful for the future of technology companies, especially, you know, who have engineers as leaders, because they're much more interested in working well with each other and not putting each other down. I mean, again, like I said earlier, these kind of manuals, I think, work very well in some settings. Yeah. But if you're talking to a 60-year-old, you know, white male who's been in business for 40 years, has a very set ways of doing things, you know, you bring up something like that to them and they just look at you like you have two heads.
Were you in that meeting with me? You just described it perfectly.
I'm often a mind reader, you know. Again, it's about context, the environment you're in, the culture you're in, the people you're working with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's changing and much more for the better.
Mm.
I've also noticed slight divergence here, but as I've got more involved in a younger generation, shall we say, doing their startups and in the creator economy, shall we say, again, mm-hmm. on LinkedIn and people around there, I've noticed increasingly that when I started my first business, everyone talked about competition and competing and how do you beat the competition.
Mm-hmm.
And there was far more discussion of business as war.
Yes.
The art of war is widely mentioned. And there's
yes.
a lot of management and strategy stuff all comes from military doctrine and
mm-hmm.
so on.
Mm-hmm.
Where now increasingly the people I'm dealing with, who are, say, under 35.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to pigeonhole, but the younger people.
Mm-hmm.
are viewing it instead as like, hey, there's a big world out there. We can all mm-hmm. collaborate. Even if mm-hmm. we appear to compete,
mm-hmm.
we can still collaborate. Let's share ideas. Let's talk. Let's see mm-hmm. how we can help each other. You know, there's plenty for everyone. More of that abundance mindset. And it's a very different mm-hmm. attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that I have a couple of networking groups of peers that, you know, we're all doing similar things, but we're helping each other. Again, I think that's a really positive change.
Oh, I agree.
So do you see any peer groups of CTOs that are helping each other that could be, yeah, a similar mirror to that?
I mean, I think there's, I think you mentioned as well on LinkedIn, Etienne from 7CTOs, as someone who has a CTO newsletter, and he then recommended Stefan, who also has, I think, the fabulous CTO newsletter. So I think that there's signs in that. I think obviously in the world, there's not as many CTOs as there are engineers. So there won't be, I would say, probably as many networks and as many newsletters as there are for engineers, because, you know, I think there's 27 million engineers in the world.
Something I don't think, like that.
Yeah.
Depending on the stats you find.
Yeah. I don't think there are as many CTOs at all, because obviously, as you'll imagine.
Yeah.
But yes, I think CTO, like, for example, CTO Craft and the CTO Academy have both asked me to collaborate with them. Even though on the surface of it, it might look like we're in competition with each other. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of collaboration between a lot of people and organizations that work with CTOs as well. It's the way the world is going, which I'm really delighted about, because I don't like this cutthroat, war kind of angle to business. I think that's a very macho, very male, very 50, 70 years ago type of attitude.
A lot of early management theory came from the military in World War II.
Yeah.
It was based around conflict. And
yeah.
Well, I'd like to say the world's changing, but sadly that's not entirely true at the moment.
Not entirely.
Okay. So is there anything else I should have asked you? Is there anything else we should talk about here?
Oh gosh, there's a million other questions that we could talk about, of course. But no, I think when, if there is one key message that I'd like to let engineers and CTOs ponder on as we're closing the episode, it would be, if everyone else doesn't seem to get it, if everyone else seems to not understand just how amazing technology is or how amazing you are for creating this technology, it means that you are not communicating it to the right level in the right way. That is my key message I'd like to let engineers, and reach out for help, because someone like me, and there's plenty of other people who do similar things to me, can help you accelerate, become a really successful CTO. Otherwise, you can be stuck in limbo between engineer and not quite CTO. And that's a very hard place to be in your career.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Adelina. Where can people find you?
On LinkedIn mainly. I'm very active there. Every day I post something. Adelina Chalmers, just after LinkedIn. That's my tag. And also geekwhisperer.co.uk is my website. You can find there my contact details. As well, if you just Google my name, there'll be lots of articles coming up anyway.
Okay, excellent. Thank you very much.